Oh.
In fact, maybe you should talk to him now. Hold on, I'm going to put you on to him and you can...
Howard hangs up the phone and switches it off.
Okay. Let's go and find these memorial gardens.
The boys brighten visibly and set off ahead of him up the street. He has read about the gardens, but never visited them. Island Bridge is an out-of-the-way and not especially inviting part of the city. Bleached posters for last year's music acts account for most of the colour to be seen. Down at heel pubs front mazy streets, where at the turn of the last century, thousands of local prostitutes attended to the needs of British soldiers stationed in the barracks that now houses the museum. It may no longer be the biggest red light zone in Europe, but it couldn't be accused of gentrification. As they turn towards the river, the grime becomes thicker, the flats more dilapidated. The boys are fascinated.
Sir, is this the ghetto?
Quiet. Do people buy drugs here?
Shh!
Are those people on drugs?
Do you want to go back to school? Is that what you want?
Sorry.
Their faith in him is at once touching and alarming. Their trust that they are safe simply because he's with them. As if an adult presence warded off all possible threat, emanated an unbreachable force field. The gate to the Memorial Gardens is at the end of a laneway, between a scrap merchant's and a mental institution. They file through one by one. Howard does not know whether to be cheered or not when they find the park deserted.
How come nobody's here?
Maybe they heard you were coming, Mario.
Yeah, Mario. They heard the biggest bomber in Dublin was on his way and they all ran inside.
You're the bomber, asshole.
Quiet, all of you.
Howard snaps. From here, aside from its eerie emptiness, the Memorial Gardens looks like any other park. The grassy lawn stretches off into the distance, rising on its left to a hill. The wind ruffles the water of the river to the right, and whispers through the leafless trees lining the avenue. The only edifice in sight is a small stone gazebo. They walk down and crowd into it. Inside, a stanza from a Rupert Brooke poem is inscribed in the floor. We have found safety with all things undying, the winds and morning, tears of men and mirth, the deep night and birds singing and clouds flying, and sleep and freedom and the autumnal earth. Look! Henry Lafayette points up the hill. A tall stone cross can now be seen, looming over the crest. They climb towards it, talking less now. Fanning out over the grass, they appear to Howard younger again, as if they are going backwards in time. At the top of the hill, they find themselves in a long garden, encircled by trees and ivy-clad colonnades. Water trickles into the basins of two identical fountains. Winter roses grow in the borders. The surrounding city can no longer be seen. They might be in the garden of a country manor, were it not for the towering cross, and, about 100 feet in front of it, a white stone sarcophagus.
Their name liveth on for evermore.
Dewey Fortune reads from its side.
Whose name?
The Irish soldiers, you spa.
They got that wrong.
Mirish says. Lucas Rexroth shivers.
This place is spooky.
This provokes a chorus of ghostly woos. But Lucas is right. The chilly air that shrinks their voices, the wet grass and lonesomeness, the strange disconnection from the world around, the inexplicable sense of having interrupted something. They give the garden the character of an afterworld. The kind of place you can imagine waking up in, stretched out on the grass, immediately after some horrific collision. The damp air swirls around them. Gradually, the boys' chatter peters out, and they shuffle about uncomfortably until each of them is facing Howard. For a moment he waits, reluctant to dispel the curious, chanting silence. Then,
okay. The Dublin Pals.
and he begins to tell them what Slattery told him about D Company. How they had joined up together from the school rugby clubs. How, while Robert Graves shivered and fought off rats in a ditch in France, they were dispatched to the furnace of the Dardanelles.
They were landed on beaches along the Gallipoli Peninsula. Hundreds of them, packed into a tiny space, waiting to be told what to do. Days went by. Dysentery, enteritis, fever broke out. Shrapnel was going off overhead the whole time. Wounded and dead men were being carried through on stretchers. Huge swarms of flies buzzed from corpses into the mouths of the living, so it was almost impossible to sleep or eat. Finally, the order came through for an attack on Karetch Tepi Sirt, a long ridge overlooking the bay. The men set out in unbearable heat that only got worse as the day went on. They hadn't been given enough water, and the Turks had poisoned the wells. They hadn't been given enough ammo either, and they soon ran out of that too. Near the top of the ridge, they found themselves pinned down by Turkish guns. They sent for reinforcements, but none came. It got so hot the gorse caught fire, and they had to listen to their own wounded being burned alive. They spent the night trapped on the mountain, being picked off one by one. When they ran out of bullets, they threw stones. One pal, Private Wilkin, started catching Turkish grenades and throwing them back. He did this 5 times before the 6th grenade exploded in his hand. At last, after hours of watching their friends being slaughtered, the men, Seabrook men, Clongowes men, St. Michael's men and others, who a week before had never been out of the country, most of them, let alone experienced enemy fire, mounted a bayonet charge on the Turkish guns. During this charge, Juster's great-grandfather, William Molloy, got shot in the hand and had to crawl back to his own lines. He was one of the lucky ones. Half the pals were lost that night. After that episode, the Allies changed their plans. The division packed up, and the remnants of the pals were split up and transferred to Salonika. As their ship sailed away, as they left their friends behind them on the cliffs and hillsides, the men vowed that their sacrifice, what had happened there, would not be forgotten. But as we've seen, it was forgotten. Or rather, it was deliberately erased. It seems pretty hard luck, after enduring so many terrible hardships and pointless deaths. But that's what happened. The years went by, and the pals became casualties again. This time, of history.
He stows his notebook in his bag, and looks up at the boys looking back at him, dotted around the Viridian sward in clumps of 3 and 4, like rain-jacketed statues.
It's hard for us, living in peacetime, to imagine the mindset of the people who lived through the war. So many men have been killed, 1 in every 6 who served, and there was barely anyone who wasn't touched by loss in some way. Fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, wives, friends. This was a world overwhelmed by grief, and the ways that the grief manifested could be quite extreme. In France, for example, there was a plague of grave robbing. Poor families spent every penny they had on locating their sons' bodies and bringing them home from the front. In Britain, there was a huge outbreak of spiritualism. Fathers and mothers held seances to speak with their dead sons. Very respectable, normally quite rational people got involved. There was even the case of the celebrated scientist, a pioneer in electromagnetic waves who believed he could use them to build a bridge between our world and the next. Tune in to the world of the dead.
He halts momentarily, thrown by Ruprecht van Doren, who was goggling at him as if he's choking on something.
Above all, though,
he fumbles for his thread.
People coped with their grief by remembering. They wore poppies in honor of their loved ones. They erected statues and built cenotaphs. And all over Europe, in villages, towns, and cities, they opened memorial gardens like this one. This particular garden was different to all the others, though. Can anyone tell me why?
He gazes evenly from face to pallid face.
This garden was never actually opened. It wasn't begun until the 30s, and it wasn't completed until the very end of the century. For the decades in between, it was let run wild. People grazed their horses here, Dealers used it to sell drugs. It was the Memorial Garden that no one remembered, and it represented most Irish people's attitude to the war, which was to bury it. The fact is that after the Easter Rising and the War of Independence, the Irishmen who'd fought in the Great War didn't fit the new way the country imagined itself. If the British were our sworn enemies, why had 200,000 Irishmen gone off to fight alongside them? If our history was the struggle to escape from British oppression, what were we doing helping Britain out, fighting and dying on her behalf? The existence of these soldiers seemed to argue against this new thing called Ireland. And so, first of all, they were turned into traitors. Then, in a quite systematic way, they were forgotten.
The boys listened palely, the loosened grass green of the empty park shimmering around them.
It's a good example of how history works. We tend to think of it as something solid and unchanging, appearing out of nowhere, etched in stone like the Ten Commandments. But history, in the end, is only another kind of story. And stories are different from the truth. The truth is messy and chaotic and all over the place. Often it just doesn't make sense. Stories make things make sense. But the way they do that is to leave out anything that doesn't fit. And often that is quite a lot. The men of D Company, like the other men who fought, found this out the hard way. They were told all kinds of stories to get them to join up. Stories about duty and morality and defending freedom. Most of all, they were told what a great adventure it would be. When they arrived, they discovered that none of these stories was true. Instead, they had been lied to and plunged into the most brutal and barbarous mess in the world's history to that point. And the history that was told of that mess was as dishonest as the stories that helped create it. When they left Dublin in 1914, with crowds cheering them on, the pals must have thought that the very least they could hope for was to be remembered. Then again, after so much betrayal, maybe the ones that were left alive afterwards weren't all that surprised it went the other way, and maybe they were wise enough not to let it get to them. They had joined up as friends, and when they got out to the front, when the grand words evaporated, the bond between them remained. That they stayed friends, that they looked out for each other, most agreed, was what kept them from cracking up altogether. And in the end, was the only thing, was the one true thing, that was genuinely worth fighting for.
He smiles summatively at the boys. They gaze mutely back at him, in their grey uniforms, for all the world like an incorporeal platoon, materialized out of the winter clouds to scour the bare park for someone who has not forgotten them. That night, for the first time in months, the construction work has stopped. The silence is so pristine as to be almost uncanny. Howard feels a light-headedness as he opens his books. The boys had been quiet on their way back to the station. At first he was afraid he had depressed them, but as the train led them out of the city, back along the coast, they emerged from their private reveries with questions.
So, like, Seabrook students back then, would all of them have been fighting in the war?
Well, like you, they had parents who were paying a lot of money for their education, so I'd guess that most would have graduated before they joined up. But plenty volunteered after that, I'm sure.
And did they get shot?
In some cases, I imagine.
Wow. I wonder if their ghosts haunt the school.
Duh. Their ghosts haunt the battlefield, you spasmo.
Oh, sorry. I forgot to consult the world-renowned ghost expert, who knows everything about where ghosts go to haunt people.
If you were interested...
Howard intervening gently.
I'm sure you could find out who joined up and what happened to them.
How?
Why don't I look into it, and we can talk about it next class.
He had shepherded them to Seabrook's double doors, and then done a swift volte-face, not yet ready to confront his fate, imagining, as he walked to his car, a hooked finger tugging down a louver of Venetian blind in an upstairs window. Tonight, though, spirits lifted by the boy's interest, he wonders if the situation is as bleak as all that, Isn't it possible that with the right spin, the story of William Malloy might snag the Automator too? A tale of Seabrook's spirit elaborated onto the world stage. A former great, let slip by history, rediscovered by his schoolmates of a century later. Wouldn't that be perfect material for, say, a 140th anniversary celebration? Perfect enough for the acting principal to overlook Howard's unorthodox, brilliantly unorthodox, methodology, and allow him to continue with his formerly recalcitrant class, his groundbreaking work.